Back to Radio Times. At a press conference earlier this summer, Speaker of the House John Boehner discussed plans to sue President Obama.
You know, the Constitution makes it clear that a president's job is to faithfully execute the laws. And in my view, the president has not faithfully executed the laws. We have a system of government outlined in our Constitution with the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Congress has its job to do, and so does the president. And when there's conflicts like this between the legislative branch and the administrative branch, it's, in my view, our responsibility to stand up for this institution in which we serve.
A few days later, Obama responded by saying this.
And as long as they insist on taking no action whatsoever that will help anybody, I'm going to keep on taking actions on my own that can help the middle class. Like the actions I've already taken to speed up construction projects and attract new manufacturing jobs and lift workers' wages and help students pay off their student loans. And they criticized me for this. Boehner sued me for this. And I told him I'd rather do things with you, pass some laws. Make sure the Highway Trust Fund is funded so we don't lay off hundreds of thousands of workers. It's not that hard. Middle class families can't wait for Republicans in Congress to do stuff. So sue me.
So last week, the House of Representatives voted to sue the president for overstepping his constitutional authority when he delayed implementation of the employer mandate part of the Affordable Care Act. Kind of complicated. The Republicans who voted against the lawsuit said they favored impeachment, something the White House appears to support. So what is going on? Does this suit have a chance? And what's all this impeachment talk about? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Will Bunch is a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, writes the paper's Attitude blog. And Will, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us is Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is right across the street from WHYY in Philadelphia. And Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be back.
So has a House of Representatives, not individuals, but a House of Representatives, ever voted to sue a president?
No, neither the House nor the Senate have ever institutionally voted to sue the president before. There have been lots of lawsuits by individual House members or groups of members of the House and Senate against the president, but they have not fared very well. For example, members of the House sued President Clinton over executive orders involving the line item veto. More recently, Representative Dennis Kucinich sued President Obama over the Libya bombing. These suits have tended to be dismissed by courts because of what's called lack of standing. The Constitution imposes a requirement under Article 3 that there be an injury in fact against an identifiable individual before a suit can proceed. And the Supreme Court in the cases like the Raines case from the 1970s have said it's difficult to prove individual injury against members of the House of Representatives when the president does something the House doesn't like. There's another barrier, and it's called the political question doctrine. Generally, courts are very reluctant to intervene in disputes between the political branches, between the president and Congress. They've said, you guys have to work this out. It's not our job to settle this for you. So although there are interesting counterarguments on the other side that Republicans have made, and we can talk about them if you like, I think the conventional wisdom is that because this suit is so novel, it will have an uphill battle in the courts.
And I want to pick up on several things. Let me turn to you, Will Bunch. It's so interesting to me that of all the things that the Boehner and the House of Representatives chose to sue the president on had to do with the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act, something that Republicans, certainly in the House and mostly in the Senate, do not support anyway. Were you surprised?
I was surprised. You know, I've been obviously following funded deliberations, and there have been a number of executive orders from President Obama, but certainly there's been a lot of controversy, for example, about his policy about drones, targeted assassinations. Obviously, those aren't issues that get a Republican conservative base very excited. But neither is the Obamacare, which is why it did surprise me. I mean, obviously, I believe they were looking for a situation where they can clearly say that Congress passed the law with this intent. You did not follow the clearly stated intent. I believe that the legal experts probably looked over his various executive actions and said this was the one in which the legal intent of Congress was the most explicit, and yet you did something else. But as you said, I mean, the irony is, I mean, the Republicans in the House who voted to do this lawsuit also voted 50 times to repeal Obamacare, including the provision that they're now suing to enforce. So it's kind of absurd. I mean, you can almost, when I heard about this, I can almost imagine Democrats running attack ads against Republicans saying, why is your congressman trying to get more regulation against small business owners? Which is essentially, if they won this lawsuit, would be the crazy political outcome of this.
But are you saying it really was to appeal to the base and maybe even to appeal to some members of the Republican Party in the House that really did favor impeachment, that this was giving them something that they could take home?
Right. I mean, what we've seen since certainly solidified since 2010 and the kind of Tea Party revolution and the wave that took back the House of Representatives for the GOP is, this constant pressure to move to the right. And we've seen, especially in the 2010 and 2012 elections, not as much this year, that Republican House members and Republican senators who don't toe the Tea Party line, who don't kind of follow the edicts as they're laid down by the talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh and at least for a time Glenn Beck, who were really
not so much anymore.
Yeah, not so much. Right? That's a whole side. That's another show. But there's been pressure. There was in 2010 there was a Republican congressman in South Carolina who went before a bunch of constituents and said, "You guys have to stop listening to Glenn Beck." And that guy was defeated, And this message was received by the Republican Party, and they, a number of incumbents faced challenges this year from Tea Party members. And there's two ways. I mean, most of the incumbents have won, but I don't believe that means the Tea Party is necessarily weakened. I think what it means is the incumbents have moved so far to adopt so many of the Tea Party positions that they protected their jobs in primaries, and this lawsuit is part of that.
Jeffrey, it looks like you want to add something.
Yeah.
I think the relationship between the lawsuit and impeachment is interesting, and Ezra Klein made a very good argument that the headline is Boehner is suing Obama so he doesn't have to impeach him, that basically Sarah Palin and others, as we've discussed, have been calling for impeachment. Boehner knows what happened the last time Republicans voted to impeach a politically popular president, and the thought here is that by putting into the courts a process that he knows is going to take a long time, he'll diffuse the pressure for immediate action without suffering the political consequences of impeachment.
You said you don't think this is going to go anywhere because the Congress doesn't have any standing. I want to just pick up on that. I mean, would someone who did have standing then be an employer who felt that they were going to be hurt by the employer mandate? Would that person have standing?
Yes, that's what happened when the Supreme Court allowed the House of Representatives collectively to intervene in the gay marriage cases, the Defense Against Marriage case, Windsor. There was an individual plaintiff who'd suffered an injury in fact. So if you could find an individual plaintiff who said that they'd been harmed by the delay of implementation of the mandate, the House could be granted standing to, or not standing, but could be allowed to intervene to support the suit. There are three other interesting arguments that Republicans make to say why this case is different from other cases where standing has not been felt. Here, the argument is that delaying the Obamacare provisions does cause harm because the legislature has to be permitted to sue because no one else will have standing if the legislature can't sue. In other words, you can't find someone who's harmed by the delay of the mandate, and therefore the legislature is the only people who can intervene. Another difference here is that there'd be formal authorization for the suit. The House voted to authorize the suit, and in the Raines case, which is the leading Supreme Court precedent, Chief Justice Rehnquist said that their members of Congress had not been authorized to represent their respective houses. Here they have been. That might make a difference. There's one final distinction that's raised, and these are all from Rivkin and Foley, who are the major thinkers who've authorized the suit, that there's no feasible political remedy here, that because the Obama actions are not serious enough to merit impeachment. This is an interesting argument. You need courts to step in because otherwise there'd be no other remedy.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I mean, talk about all these branches of government here. But in Boehner's perspective, he says it's, you know, Congress passes laws. And it's the executive. What does the executive do?
But the executive takes care of the laws are faithfully executed.
Okay, all of a sudden I forgot how our government
and
works.
And executes them.
the Senate passes the law. The president signs it. Exactly.
but is it really that simple?
Well, no, it's not. as the president's defenders have noted, presidents make decisions about the order in which to enforce laws all the time. In fact, President Bush. Decided to delay the implementation of certain Medicaid provisions, mm-hmm. and I'm looking for the exact president right
here. You have a gigantic stack of papers.
I know. I've come well prepared.
Almost worse than me,
at the Constitution Center, we do our homework.
I'm so happy.
And here's
that.
The right example. In 2006, when he was president, George W. Bush chose to waive Medicaid Part D penalties for low-income and disabled seniors who signed up late. And the quote from McClatchy is, officials determined that collecting the fees from poor beneficiaries would cost more than the penalties themselves. The move was motivated to make sure Congress didn't pass legislation permanently removing the late enforcement penalties. Here, too, in addition to citing that precedent, the president's defenders, like the thoughtful Cy Lazarus of the Constitutional Accountability Center, say that this is not a decision not to enforce the law. It's a decision about precisely when to phase in the law given limited resources. He goes on to say that it's absurd to suggest that the Congress that passed the Affordable Care Act wouldn't have wanted the president to implement it in a way that would make it work, and therefore it doesn't make sense to say that the president is flouting the will of Congress.
And about a minute before I have to break, take a break here. Go ahead, Will Bunch.
Yeah, right. I mean, the job of the president is to enforce the law wisely. And you know, I mean, this, you know, other than deciding which bills to sign and which bills to veto, I mean, that's the main part of his job. I mean, you know, we all agree that we should have clean water and clean air, and we pass laws to do that. But much of the debate over the environment is how the EPA and the federal government implements those laws, and either the president or the person he has running these agencies or departments make these decisions every day. You know, there's really no evidence that President Obama has used his powers any differently than the people who've come before him. In fact,
these are the executive.
Yes, I mean
orders.
The executive orders that he's issued. The actual number, he's at a pace that is much less than the majority of his predecessors. Going back to FDR. And the New Deal.
That's a very important point that I want to echo. Several studies have found that President Obama has issued fewer executive orders than any president since Grover Cleveland.
Wow, we have to go back to Grover Cleveland.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
And he didn't issue a whole lot either.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. Also with us, Will Bunch. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. You probably know his blog called Attitude, which is how we say attitude here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about the fact that the U.S. House of Representatives voted to sue the president last week. There's also been a lot of impeachment talk these days, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The National Museum of American Jewish History at Fifth and Market supports WHYY and presents Chasing Dreams, Baseball and Becoming American, the first large-scale family-friendly exhibition to focus on the role baseball has played in the lives of immigrant and minority communities as they sought to understand or challenge American culture and ideals. From Hank Greenberg to Jackie Robinson, Chasing Dreams highlights the stories of baseball's barrier breakers and change makers on view through October 26th. NMAJH.org or 215-923-3811.
Hi, I'm Stephen Quinn. Charlotte Lebon is a Canadian actress who left her native Quebec to forge a career in France. Now she's taking on Hollywood in a movie called The 100-Foot Journey. Charlotte Lebon, coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Most people never read those long user agreements when they sign up for everything from music streaming to email. So why do people accept them?
If you don't click accept, you basically have to opt out of the internet.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're getting a political and constitutional analysis of the lawsuit that was approved on, voted on last week by the U.S. House of Representatives to sue the president for overstepping his constitutional authority. And the lawsuit relates to the delaying of the implementation of the employer mandate of the Affordable Care Act. That's what we're talking about with our guests, Will Bunch and Jeffrey Rosen. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And we're curious about what you make of what is going on, because we've been in a bit scratching our heads. Back to you, Will Bunch. It is interesting, and this is a more, I guess, there are political reasons for this. The White House and the president seem to say, as the president said in that clip, sue me, you know, bring it on. Yeah. He seems to be doing the same thing with impeachment, thinking that this is probably a good political issue for him and perhaps even his party.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back, you know, if there was a stray House member or somebody who was bringing up the idea the president should be impeached, or if you go back to the Iran-Contra scandal with Reagan, the reaction from the White House would be to dismiss this. You know, this is absurd. Outrageous or absurd that the president should be impeached. And in this case, it was fascinating that the White House sent its people out front and center and said, you know, we're very worried about this impeachment threat. You know, we take this very seriously, and which generated headlines, you know, and White House concerned about and kept the story going for another news cycle. And
but clearly they see a benefit of that.
They do. I mean, they see a couple benefits. One that's been much discussed is fundraising. Basically, they know. They know that this idea outrages people in their base, particularly African American, Latino voters, who see this, you know, and maybe they're lukewarm, you know. I mean, there's some debate about how well President Obama's policies have actually helped people in inner cities and the lower middle class. But, and some of those people may be lukewarm, but when they see this existential threat to the Obama presidency from people that they don't like, you know, the Tea Party, Republicans, it does get people worked up. And so that helps in two ways. One is fundraising. They send out these emails and say, you know, can you believe the Republicans want to impeach the president? You know, please give us $5, you know, whatever. You know, and they send these things out. But the other thing is, they're looking ahead to November. I mean, historically, Democrats, and particularly the type of voters we were talking about, minority voters, lower middle-class voters, working-class folks, have a much lower turnout rate in midterm elections. They do tend to vote in presidential years, and that's accrued to President Obama's benefit in 08 and 2012 when he ran. But in 2010, the Democrats got swamped, and part of the reason was these voters stayed home. And with impeachment, they see a golden opportunity, frankly, to get people excited, worked up, you know, that if you don't come out and vote.
Well, it seems like both sides do, that the Republicans see a benefit as well.
Of course, yeah, exactly. They're, you know, that they, it's raising the stakes, you know, that we're not just, this isn't just about, you know, not that immigration reform isn't reported, but this is about, you know, the very existence of the Obama presidency. You know, that really, it almost makes it into a quasi-presidential election in a way when you elevate it to that level.
Let me turn to you, Jeffrey. As someone, you're president of the National Constitution Center, are you bothered by the fact that people are throwing this, you know, impeachment, sue the president, throwing these words around in what feels like a kind of knee-jerk, almost willy-nilly fashion?
Bothered. It's bad for the country, but it's great for the National Constitution Center. We get to have debates.
You're all about that. I get that,
Jeffrey. It's all about debates 24/7. Look, this is a venerable part of American political history. We've obviously had three impeachments, Johnson and and Clinton and nearly Nixon. And but it is the case that the past three presidencies, the second terms have ended in impeachment talk, and they've ended in more legalization and lawsuits. And what's interesting and I suppose unpredictable here is you can never tell what courts will do. As we saw just last week with a surprise to some ruling by the D.C. Circuit to accept a rather technical challenge to the Affordable Care Act's decision to include federally created mandates under its tax subsidy provision, a theory that even its proponents in a great debate at the National Constitution Center viewed as unlikely to succeed when it was first made, some judge might go for anything. And then even when you bring a lawsuit, which the conventional wisdom says is far-fetched, if you get a court or two to buy it and you get some traction, then that by itself could create a justification for impeachment that's harder to resist. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what happened with Clinton. Remember that crazy Rube Goldberg progress of events that led to the indictment over so-called obstruction of justice and lying? Once the lawyers are involved, unexpected stuff can happen. So I think it would be premature to say these are totally frivolous suits and nothing at all is going to happen to them.
We had a caller that couldn't stay on, but they wanted to know, could the president, I mean, if the House of Representatives is suing the president or authorizing a lawsuit against the president, could the president sue Congress?
That is a very great question, and that's a concern that if the courts were to relax their traditional standing requirements, then the president could sue Congress over, for example, failure to hold a hearing on his judicial nominee. So standing, here's the technical term. This is all being sued under something called the Declaratory Judgment Act. There has to be an injury in fact. That's a genuine harm, not a theoretical harm. Also, there has to be a proof that the other side caused the injury. And finally, the injury has to be the kind that a court can actually remedy by ruling in favor of the suing party. So the concern here, and it's tended to be conservatives who are very rigorous about standing requirements and keeping people out of courts for suing for so fanciful injuries. The fear is that if this suit were to proceed, Obama could absolutely say, Congress is harming me and my duties to exercise my constitutional powers. I'm going to sue you.
Yeah,
well, go ahead.
I just wanted to add one thing about in regard to your question about tossing around impeachment, and really, I mean, to me, what interests me the most about this whole story is just the changing definition of impeachment. Let's start by remembering what impeachment is. Impeachment is laid out in the Constitution is the potential removal from office for high crimes and misdemeanors. In other words, it's in a way, it's kind of a political form of prosecution. When somebody commits wrong, it is or isn't always possible to criminally charge somebody. But this is the way that we deal with a political misconduct that really is criminal in nature. The impeachment. This issue is fascinating my whole life. I mean, I became a journalist basically because of the impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon. I was 14. I was a teenage Watergate geek. I raced home from summer camp every afternoon to watch John Dean testify. John Dean following me on Twitter was the most exciting thing that happened to me this year.
Congratulations.
So, yeah.
I guess last week on Radio Times.
Yes, yeah, so exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the reason it excited me was because you did have a president who committed high crimes and misdemeanors, and how was that going to play out? And it ended up playing out in his resignation. And, as we all said over and over again back in the 70s, the system worked and all of that. Yeah. And then something changed, the two prime cases here, I mean, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, behaved poorly, but it was not the conduct of his job. I mean, whatever dishonesty occurred was about his personal life. And so, you redefine definition. And here, what's happening here with the potential impeachment of President Obama, it's almost parliamentary. It's almost like a vote. It's almost becoming like a vote of no confidence. I mean, clearly no crimes have been committed here. So, impeachment is becoming a solely political act devoid of that whole criminal context.
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
That's a very thoughtful analysis. And it's true that although in theory impeachment is whatever Congress says it is,
sure,
as Gerald Ford famously observed in the ill-fated attempts to impeach Justice William O. Douglas, in practice, the verdict of history, as Will says, has been that impeachment should be reserved only for serious criminal activity or for willful attempts to thwart or subvert the Constitution. And it's absolutely true that more recently it's tended to be used as a sort of political device. It's interesting that there are many claims that President Obama is subverting the law right now, especially in his executive orders, which Republicans claim are thwarting the will of Congress, ranging from immigration to labor rights to gay rights and the environmental laws. But as Will said earlier, this is the supposed constitutional transgression that seemed to Republicans the clearest. Those other examples, it's hard to argue that he openly flouted the explicit will of Congress. Rather, he was acting within what courts have called a zone of twilight. Mm. I also agree with Will that if you're going to look for particular areas where Obama, like his predecessor, President Bush, is arguably flouting clear congressional constraints, it's more in the national security arena, where things like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Patriot Act are being stretched in ways that its proponents, both Republican and Democrats, have objected to. But because there's no political constituency for resisting those arguable constitutional transgressions, Republicans are scrambling to find other violations. And I really agree with Will that this represents a change in the meaning of impeachment.
But does that bother you? I mean, that we can use it in that less meaningful way.
I mean, again,
reserved for these really egregious violations.
I really feel, you know, both as at the Constitution Center and as a constitutional lawyer, I think debate is a good thing. It's not bad for the country that people are trying to use the courts or use the impeachment process to achieve their ends and being beaten back. All of us feel here that ultimately these efforts are not going to succeed. And there's nothing wrong with trying to stretch constitutional procedures in ways that they weren't intended to do if that results in precedents that end up defining them more narrowly and the way the framers intended. So I think the debate is healthy, and it certainly lets off steam, which is a good thing as well.
Indeed it does, and that's Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. In fact, the center is right across the street from WHYY. Will Bunch also with us. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. He writes the paper's Attitude blog, and we are talking about impeachment and suing the president and some of the constitutional issues at play, and also some of the politics involved as well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow. And we want to know what you think. Let me get Helen from Cape May, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Helen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm a recovering attorney myself.
Congratulations.
Yes, good. How many days?
12 steps.
12 steps,
you can stick with it.
there are two individual lawsuits out there attacking the president regarding the non-enforcement of the employer mandate. One is from an employer in the Midwest, and the other is from an employer who's a dentist in Florida who has said that he has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars preparing for the employer mandate, and he's been personally injured. So I don't have the site for you. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I just heard the program and called. And the other thing is, I think the president has exceeded his constitutional authority, but I also think that the lawsuit is silly. I think what they have the power of the purse, cut off the funding, stop funding executive orders you don't like, and that's the remedy, not this dog and pony show of a lawsuit. But I do think the president has exceeded what the Constitution allows him to do.
Helen, I appreciate
it. You're doing a great job, guys, and I love to listen to you.
Thanks so much, Helen. Yeah, go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, Helen, that's incredibly useful information. Thank you for noting those two suits. And as we discussed earlier, those suits, I think even the House has acknowledged, have a greater chance of proceeding in court than the House lawsuit itself, because those private individuals can argue at least that they have an injury in fact, and then the House might intervene to support those lawsuits. Now, still, on the merits, I'm not betting on those suits succeeding. Opponents of the whole idea of a lawsuit note that the House itself voted to delay implementation of the mandate for a year, suggesting that the president's decision to do the same thing is hardly inconsistent with Congress's intent. But it's a more straightforward way of proceeding, and thanks, Helen, and I'll look forward to tracking down the details of those two lawsuits.
Yeah, Helen, thanks so much for calling into Radio Times and talking about, I guess, inconsistency to you, Will Bunch, because Boehner said recently this had to do with the migration crisis on the border, and this is a quote here, this is about the president, there are numerous steps the president can and should be taking right now without the need for congressional action to secure our borders, ensure these children are returned swiftly and safely to their countries. This is shortly after the House voted to sue the president for, in a sense, sort of overstepping his authority.
Well, you can just get dizzy spinning around with the ironies here, because that's kind of bizarre. But also, the other thing is, there's been a lot of talk on the political front that between now and the November election, that President Obama may issue a much more sweeping executive order on immigration, that he could possibly offer some sort of amnesty type, you know, we'll have to see the provisions, but some type to possibly millions of people who are in this country undocumented. And, you know, I mean, that gets to the point of whether, you know, the Obama administration. I mean, I think that's good policy, but in terms of doing it that way, is he really trying to provoke a constitutional crisis?
You know? That's interesting.
Yeah. You know, one thing that interests me just quickly is, Jeffrey brought it up, and I think the caller alluded to this too, is, we've always been trying to figure out this balance of power between Congress and the president. And, I'm going back to that Watergate period. It was the same period we had the War Powers Act when, Congress tried to place some limits on the exercise of military power by the president. And we always had that, and we'd like to see some. I think people would like to see some of these resolved. It's just the question of what's the right venue. I mean, one unresolved issue that goes back to the Bush administration is this whole idea of signing statements. There was a big controversy, and many of people who share my progressive ideals were outraged at President Bush for these signing statements, where he would sign laws, but he said, "But I'm not going to do this part of it because I don't think it's right or whatever." And people, Charlie Savage, the journalist who's now with the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of this. And President Obama said he was going to discontinue this when he ran in 2008, and he has not. He's continued to issue signing statements, and I think the public would like to see some of these issues clarified. It's just, it doesn't seem like the way the House is going about it is the best way.
Yeah, Jeffrey, what do you think?
I think Will is absolutely right that President Obama has continued the inexorable trend of recent presidents of expanding executive power rather than contracting it in just the ways that he has suggested. And the courts are not necessarily the best venue for resolving this. His thoughts about the immigration executive orders are interesting, and I agree that if President Obama were merely to say he's delaying deportation, that would be within his discretion. But if he were to say he's refusing to deport, contrary to the terms of the act, that would be a kind of provocation. This brings us to, we have to, if you'll forgive me for the quick constitutional primer on the way the courts look at these executive power questions. So there's one totemic, fascinating opinion that all readers, all listeners in August who want a great constitutional treat should look up. It's the Steele seizure case, Youngstown case. It's 1952. President Truman wants to seize the steel mills because they're threatening to strike, and he thinks this will endanger national security. And the Supreme Court holds 6-3 that Congress has not authorized the suit, and the president does not have the power as commander-in-chief to do this on his own without congressional authorization. And Justice Robert Jackson, who is the most beautiful writer of the 20th century on the court, so his opinion is great to read for that reason, says there are three categories of presidential power. When the president acts with explicit congressional support, his power is at its highest ebb. When he acts in the face of explicit congressional disapproval, his power is at its lowest ebb. And when Congress hasn't been clear on the matter, the president acts in what Jackson wonderfully called a zone of twilight. And that zone of twilight music is reinforcing this point. But the question here is, which of the executive orders are in the zone of twilight? Twilight zone.
Ooh, exactly. Ooh. I'm going to pick up on that after this short break. Believe it or not, we are talking about important constitutional issues in this hour of Radio Times with Jeffrey Rosen and with Will Bunch and with you, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. Graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Sabrina Tavernisi describes her experiences as one of the first reporters at the site of the downed Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, where she felt alone with the dead. She spent several weeks covering the conflict in Ukraine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Feminists, put down your weapons and pick up your minds.
I'm honest about my contradictions and my inconsistencies and that I'm not, always on the right side. But I'm willing to stand up and say, yes, I am a feminist.
Roxane Gay is a feminist, a bad feminist. More about that next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia. Also with Will Bunch. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, and he writes a very fun and popular blog called Attitude, ATTYTOOD. That's how we say the word attitude here in Philadelphia. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9 499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Jeffrey, let me go back to you. Just you gave us the steel seizure case and these three reasons why I guess then President Truman could or couldn't do what he wanted to do. Taking it to present day, and what we hear, we were talking about this during the break, what we hear from the president is, look, Congress, they won't do anything, they won't act on anything, so it's really my responsibility, it's my job to take these actions.
Yes, and the interesting legal question is, when Congress refuses to take an action and the president takes it on his own, is he acting within that zone of twilight, which you play the great music to accompany, or is he acting in the face of congressional disapproval? And you can argue this round or flat, as the lawyers say, but take, for example, his decision to impose certain background gun checks that Congress has refused to enact. His supporters say, since there's no congressional statement on the matter, he's acting in the zone of twilight, and courts have tended to be deferential to the president in that zone. His opponents say the fact that Congress considered and refused to enact those limitations means that he's acting in the face of congressional disapproval. Trying to be as neutral as possible, mm-hmm. I'd put it somewhere between the two categories, and generally courts are extremely deferential to the president. Justices of both political persuasions have been highly reluctant to challenge the president. The steel seizure case is a rarity. So again, and the fact that Republicans have not chosen to file suit over these other executive orders suggests they've come to the same conclusion.
We have a tweet from Nathan. When will America wake up and vote out this do-nothing Congress who can't do anything but shut down the government and block the president? And, I mean, that's one point of view, Will, but it's obviously the point of view that probably is in support of the president and maybe even supports these or is energized by this lawsuit and this talk of impeachment.
Right. And you have to remember, for every person who feels the way from your tweeter, and he may be from a very blue congressional district where this is a common attitude of, you know, let the president do his job. I mean, somewhere else there's a congressman from Utah or from Alabama who goes home and, you know, the motivation for, you know, first this lawsuit and then this talk of impeachment. I mean, these people have been saying for 6 years now that President Obama is a tyrant. I mean, it's kind of flabbergasting how many times the words tyrannical and tyrant have been used by Republicans, both members of Congress, but also their constituents. Like I said, we were talking to talk radio hosts, either nationally or the people who are on the air in their district, to, you know, say President Obama's a tyrant. These congressmen go home for their town meetings and they say, yes, I agree with you. And then the question becomes, all right, well, you're a congressman. You just said the president is a tyrant. He's abusing his office. Didn't we elect you to do something about this? Mm. And so I think, you know, I think when you wonder, well, where's this pressure to impeachment comes? I mean, sure. I mean, you're elected to office to take care of problems. And if you and your constituents think the problem is that the president is a tyrant, then, you know, obviously that would motivate you to do something. I mean, obviously, the problem here is whether the president is a tyrant or just doing what every president before him has done. But so that's the political countervailing to, you know, why don't we vote these Congress people out? I mean, that's half the public feels that way, mm-hmm. and half the public says, why haven't they impeached him yet?
Right. Well, and I probably should have said this earlier in the hour. We did invite a number of Republicans who had voted for the suit to join us, who are basically suburban and New Jersey based Republicans, to tell us why they voted to sue, and either they couldn't join us or didn't want to join us or didn't call us back. But I mean, we did.
Yeah. They were washing their hair.
Important dentist appointment. You know, it's August.
Well, I just wanted our listeners to know why we didn't have that voice, and we did try, certainly. Let me get Rick from Hockessin, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you again for the watch. The interesting topic. My question is, I think it's one of the problems with these suits is it's visceral. there's not a relationship with Congress and this president. He's a loner, doesn't have a lot of friends, and it's unfortunate. And it reminds you of Carter's presidency when he had a Democratic Congress, and it was just terrible between Nixon, Ford, and Carter. And one of the things I think is happening is almost personal. It's not so much about laws, it's physical. It's a lack of personal relationship between the two sides, and they can't get along. And it speaks badly of both. I don't know whose fault it is, but I think it's more, I look at the legal talk, but I also look at the very personal side of it.
I hear you, Rick. No, I appreciate you calling in, although I'm thinking that Clinton was impeached and he did have relationships with Congress. But what do you think about that, Jeffrey?
I thought of the same counterexample, but then I think the caller is right that there is something about the personalization of politics that has led both sides to demonize each other in a way that makes impeachment talk easier than it was in the days of Lyndon Johnson, when, despite the vigorous political disagreements, both sides at least could talk to each other. And it's interesting that the entire political question doctrine that the courts invoke to stay out of disputes between the president and Congress is premised on the idea that they can work things out themselves, that basically you risk embarrassing the two branches when you intercede as judges and don't allow the ordinary processes of political negotiation to take place. And it's fascinating that the Republicans, in filing their suit here, have said, we can't work it out anymore, and that's why you courts have to intervene. And I think that's a really strong point. The personalization of politics, the demonization, the politics of personal destruction may indeed play a role in the increase of impeachment talk.
I think that's
Obama's not a schmoozer, we've heard.
I'm glad. I think your caller was right on the money. I mean, I think clearly, and I think his examples were right on the money. I think President Obama, like President Clinton, were not the people who, you know, were getting on the phone, calling members of Congress, you know, from 8 at night till midnight and
schmoozing.
Do you
think Bush was, though?
Less, and that's probably what I'm going to get into about how politics has changed a lot. I mean, you know, I mean, Lyndon Johnson's funny. I mean, we all pine on issue when we talk about issues like civil rights or domestic policy. You know, we forget about Vietnam, and we all pine for LBJ and how he could you know, twist arms and also cajole and influence and do all those things. And he was.
And
he
throw
was
a, earmarks around,
right.
Too.
Well, that's it. There's a couple things you have to remember. One is the thing about earmarks is, I mean, what he was great at doing is he would call you in and say, look, I need you on the civil rights bill. You want that dam in your district, don't you? And what's changed is modern Republicans, thanks to the Tea Party, they don't want dams in their district anymore. They actually, you know, any kind of government spending, even in their own district, is, you know, pillory, it is wasteful now, and so you can't make those kind of deals. It's, you know, I think what's his name, Ben Nelson, the senator from Nebraska, was savaged by his constituents for winning a concession on Obamacare that would have helped Nebraska. Normally, that's what people used to do in the 60s, right. And now the politics, it's just the ideology has changed. And the other thing is, you know, back in Lyndon Johnson's time, you had conservative Democrats in the South, and you also had this incredibly disappeared breed called liberal Republicans in the North. You had Jacob Javits in New York, and you had Lowell Weicker, in Connecticut, and Senator Brooke in Massachusetts, Edward Brooke, and you know, things flipped when the South flipped. Then eventually Northern voters said, well, you know, why are we supporting these, you know, crazy Sunbelt folks? And they went more Democrat. And so now there's just an ideological divide that it's really hard. It's hard to imagine what President Obama would get on the phone and say or cajole a congressman from Mississippi to do that would get him to change his mind or get him to like President Obama. I just don't see it. I mean, it's unfortunate that he's not a schmoozer, but I don't know what schmoozing would actually accomplish.
That's interesting. Let me get, looks like Jake from Huntington Valley to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jake. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, everybody.
Hi there.
I just wanted to call and ask what remedies there might be for the fractured political landscape, because it seems like it's really damaging, you know, people's ability to believe in our political system, both the people, you know, the Congress and the president. So just wanted to see if panelists had any thoughts about that.
Let me toss that first to you, Jeffrey Rosen.
We're starting up a project at the National Constitution Center on this very question. What are the constitutional remedies for polarization? And we're trying to get some good thinkers to answer your great question. They've just started their work, but some possible things that people have proposed are the end of partisan gerrymandering. It's really the fact that these districts are drawn in ways that guarantee safe seats that increases the extremism on both the left and the right, because in the old days you could run in a primary to the left and the right and you'd have to come to the middle in the general. Now that the seat is safe, you have to stay extreme left or right. That has polarized the House, and since more than half of the Senate comes from the House, it's polarized the Senate. Another suggestion people have made is that open primaries tend to be helpful, as California has found, and lead to more moderate people. And blue ribbon commissions that do redistricting are useful, too. These are some constitutional-level ideas, and we hope to come up with a lot more in our great anti-polarization project at the National Constitution Center.
Do you have any remedies, Will?
I think those are good ones that Jeffrey suggested, because otherwise, I mean, the only things really in the last generation, the only things that have brought people together have been not constitutional but emotional remedies. I mean, 9/11
like a crisis of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, 9/11 is the one example, and heaven forbid we don't want another 9/11. So how do we bring people together under perhaps less emotional times? It's a shame. I mean, I look at, you know, I've written about this. I mean, I look at the situation like this refugee crisis on the southern border, and it seems like children in peril would be something that would bring people from both parties together. And the fact that even that can't bring people together is kind of heartbreaking to me personally. But these are the times we live in. But you know, just right. I mean, I think the California system, you know, we see in these ultra Democratic districts, you get these November elections with a moderate Democrat running against a liberal Democrat, and that does give people a choice, and people want choice. So that's, you know, any way we can increase that.
Let me go back to you, Jeffrey, and even going back to this lawsuit. I mean, what is then the process? What's the route that this lawsuit would take?
I'm shuffling my papers again.
Such an impressive pile of papers.
No,
too.
It's just really amazing how many trees we're killing.
I know. I'm hoping those all get recycled.
So, I want here it is. It's, and I want to recommend, this is a great explainer from Vox. Why the House of Representatives just voted to sue President Obama. And at the end, it talks about how it will proceed. And basically, I'm not going to get it right away, so I'll just say it's going to go up to district court, and they will decide how far to let it proceed. And it could be thrown out for lack of standing right away, which many people think is the most likely process, or the court could allow the suit to – here it is – so it's filed on behalf of the House of Representatives. Five House leaders called the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group are convened, and they represent the House. The lawsuits filed in federal district court could theoretically, I'm reading from this Vox article, be appealed to the D.C. Circuit and eventually to the Supreme Court. If the courts find the House does have standing to sue and then rules in their favor, Obama would likely be ordered to implement the employer mandate. Theoretically, it would be up to him to comply. If he refused to do so, this is the great punchline, he'd certainly fuel cries for his impeachment, and those would be more legitimate demands, because remember, it was President Andrew Johnson's refusal to enforce the Tenure in Office Act that led to his impeachment. That's why I said earlier, these lawsuits can play tricks on you, and if they do proceed, what happens in a lawsuit might be the basis for a subsequent impeachment claim that would be a whole lot stronger than the claims are right now.
There's a bit of a jarring segue here, but this is to you, Will. The 113th Congress has been called the least productive, I think, maybe on record or ever, or I'm not sure how long.
It's hard. I've tried to get an answer on that, and it's a complicated thing to come up with, but it's clearly up near the top, absolutely.
But the criteria is how many laws are passed, and I kind of wonder, is that a good criteria? Because there could be good laws, there could be bad laws, there could be naming of post offices, assuming there are post offices that don't have names yet.
Right.
Is that a good criteria to talk about whether a Congress is, you know, effective or not?
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point, because clearly this is what Republican congressmen, you know, that they being the majority party in the House right now, go home to the constituents and say, that's like,
we're doing,
you know,
our job.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, two things. I mean, one is they say they're not passing bad bills that would be destructive to the country, and also generally they come from a more libertarian philosophy that government that does least does best, right? So they're certainly living up to that. They're doing less. But I think, you know, I think if you look at the public opinion polls, I think, you know, I think there's a desire from the public to see action on a lot of fronts. I mean, we've talked a lot about immigration this hour. People want to see action on immigration. You know, they want to see action on
infrastructure, for instance.
Absolutely. I was going to say unemployment. I mean, we have too many long-term unemployed, and people wonder why they can't get their act together on unemployment benefits for these poor folks who have been out of a job for 6 months or a year or 2 years. So I think if you look at the numbers, I don't think the argument that the public wants inaction is really supported
politically. What do you think, Jeffrey?
The poll I read suggests that at least Republican members of the public also want impeachment. I think the number was 57% in one of these pieces. So if representatives are supposed to respond to their constituents, then maybe the Republicans are doing their job. Mm.
Do we have too many laws in this country?
Well, at the National Constitution Center, we disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis, so I have no opinion about that.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Really enjoyed it. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much.
Thanks. It was so much fun.
And fun for us as well. President and CEO of the National Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, Will Bunch, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News. Check out his blog, Attitude. Also, go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can download a podcast of this or bunch of other shows as well. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We've got a weekly newsletter, and you can find us on satellite radio and much, much more. That's whyy.org/radiotimes. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Ariel Plotnick, our intern this summer. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you say